permanent government.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is January 19th, 2010. This is episode 342. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the sorts of things that are often labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email me at gscott@gmail.com or through the virtual auditorium on PalTalk by text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you are listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question answered, please feel free to email it to me and I'll ask it for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it into text, and I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And if I don't catch it right away, please feel free to repeat it. For those of you who like to feel connected, I'm on Facebook and on Twitter, so you can link to me there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, so look for that as well. This past week, there has been a lot of depressing news about Haiti coming in, and my thoughts and prayers go out to all of the victims who are now struggling for survival in the middle of all that devastation. Americans are known for their generosity towards the victims of a disaster, but I would like to offer a word of caution to all those who are preparing to open your wallets. Choose with care. There are a lot of agencies out there with very poor track records of delivering aid, and they're holding their hands out and promising to save Haiti. One of the safest ways is right through the White House, and you can see it at www.whitehouse.gov when you click on the article about Haiti. Essentially, you can donate $10 to the cause by texting QUAKE, Q-U-A-K-E, to 2022. That number again is 2022. This $10 donation will be added to your phone bill and goes to the ClintonBushHaitiFund.org. There's also the option of finding it on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can donate through the Internet right to the same organization. Now, Haiti had more than half of its population under the age of 18, and this is the same group that is most severely injured in a disaster such as this because of their smaller body size and weaker bones. They are also the most vulnerable as survivors. And there are untold numbers of orphan children roaming the ruined streets trying to stay alive. As the death tolls rise, so will the number of predators looking for young victims. And it's important to get these orphans into safe locations and provide them with education and the basics of life to prepare them to become productive adults. Each day that passes, more children will fall victim to disease, injuries, malnutrition, dehydration, and predatory adults. Fortunately, the normal processes to remove some of these orphans from Haiti have been expedited, and orphans that were waiting for visas and permits to leave Haiti are already making their way to several countries where they will be cared for until their adoptions are approved and they can join their adoptive families. According to the news, 65 arrived in the USA today, but that's a mere drop in the bucket of thousands of orphans. In another note, I would like to extend my most sincere hopes for the best outcome to Jerry Smith. He was a guest on the show fairly recently, but he has been diagnosed with non-operative pancreatic cancer. And I got the news via Facebook yesterday. So, you know, that's one of those sad things that happen, and he said he should get a prognosis and more information in the next couple of weeks. Now, disasters have always been a part of human history, and often these disasters result in changes that leave the previous civilization in the dust, forgotten as time marches on. Often not even the source or type of disaster is recorded in the past, and we can do nothing but wonder who and why things happen and how a civilization came to an end. One area of very intense interest has always been ancient Egypt, which has a known connection with many ancient cultures. Much is known about their history, yet much remains a mystery. Such is the story of the Dogon as well. That's a tribe in Africa. Tonight's guest is Laird Scranton, author of two books about the Dogon and a source of immense amounts of information. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Dawn of Shades once again. Laird, welcome to the program.
Dia, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you are here. So one of the first things I always ask every guest to do is to introduce themselves to the audience. For those who are not familiar with their names, voices, and the things that they've done, how could you do that for us tonight?
Okay, well, as you've indicated, I'm the author of several books on ancient mythology and language. I have two published books and one in the process of publication through Inner Traditions. The first book is called The Science of the Dogon, D-O-G-O-N. And the second is called Sacred Symbols of the Dogon. And my approach to ancient studies is sort of a different one, in that I tackle it by beginning with what is actually a modern-day tribe, an African tribe from Mali called the Dogon. That may seem like a backwards approach to a study of ancient myths and language, but the Dogon present us with a really interesting and unique opportunity because they represent a kind of a crossroads for a number of different ancient traditions, including ancient Judaism, ancient Egypt, Buddhism, and as we go along, we'll realize that there are connections to other cultures. So my approach has been to begin to look at the Dogon. As I said, they are a modern tribe, a living tribe, which gives us certain advantages. While we can't talk with an ancient Egyptian priest because there aren't any left living, we can sit down and talk to a Dogon priest. And a Dogon priest is in a position to tell us in modern terms, to give us explanations of what their symbols and their myths mean. And a lot of these symbols and myths and words are very closely related, or seem to be very closely related, to ancient Egyptian myths, symbols, and words. And so the opportunity presents itself to learn more about ancient culture by pursuing the religion of this modern tribe.
That's now, very, you know, it's fascinating to see the connection with a modern civilization clear back to one of the most ancient of ancient civilizations. How did you discover the connection?
Okay, I was reading for pleasure back in the mid-1990s. I was reading a book called Unexplained by Jerome Clark. And this is a book my wife had given me, and each chapter in the book discusses some other unsolved mystery of the world that might be of interest. And one of the chapters is dedicated to the Dogon. And the reason they were interested in the Dogon is because the Dogon seemed to have some knowledge of astronomy that they shouldn't have, seeing as how they're an outwardly primitive tribe without any, you know, modern telescopes or any way of ostensibly learning about astronomy. And so I started pursuing the Dogon, started following the few sources there were about the Dogon. I read Robert Temple's book, The Serious Mystery, which discusses possible ways the Dogon might have known about astronomy. And then I began pursuing the religious studies that were conducted by French anthropologists of the Dogon back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. The anthropological studies that explain in great detail what the myths and symbols are about based on explanations from the Dogon priests.
Uh-huh. And how did you associate the Dogon with the early Egyptians?
Okay, well, the first thing that caught my attention, from a professional standpoint, I am a software designer. And so what that means from a practical standpoint, every day in my job involves creating symbols and creating symbolic words to represent things in a computer program. And there's certain techniques that I use as I do my job to make it easier for whoever follows me to understand what it is I was trying to accomplish in a program. And I noticed that certain of the techniques that I used professionally, I could see someone had used in relation to the Dogon symbols. There was intelligence behind the symbols, and that someone had made conscious choices. If you're going to in a computer program pick a symbol to represent an invoice number for a business, you wouldn't probably call it XYZ. You'd probably call it something that began with INVNO. Make it easier for the next programmer to realize that this symbol represents an invoice number. Well, when I realized that those kinds of choices had been made for Dogon symbols, it occurred to me that these were design symbols, and I decided I wanted to find out more about who had designed them and what some of the purpose might have been behind their design. Then the farther I got, the deeper I got into exploring them, I started to notice similarities to things I knew about from Judaism and things I already had read about ancient Egypt, certain myths in common and certain mythological characters in common and certain storylines in common. And I started to connect the dots between the Dogon and the Egyptians. As it turns out, the Dogon civic traditions are so close to what happened in ancient Egypt that you can find evidence of almost everything that Dogon does in ancient Egypt. My presumption at this point is that if the Dogon do it, the chances are very good the ancient Egyptians did it. For example, and also there are connections to ancient Judaism. For example, the Dogon circumcised like the Egyptians did and the ancient Jews did, modern Jews do. They wear skull caps, they wear prayer shawls, they celebrate a jubilee year. And so there's a large overlap religiously in religious rituals between the Dogon, the Egyptians, and Judaism. The civic traditions of the Dogon are very similar, down to the point where the Dogon name their, when they establish a new district or a new village, they always establish them in pairs called upper and lower, same way the ancient Egyptians did. They used the same calendars the ancient Egyptians did, and they regulate their seasons the same way and track the timing of the seasons the same way. And as it turns out, a lot of the words of the Dogon religion, when you get down to it, are actually ancient Egyptian words, and you can draw parallels between the words and the meanings.
And how about the rest of their language? Is it also very similar?
The Dogon language is a special case. It's not really a classifiable language because it's made up of sub-languages, many different, maybe as many as 15 different sub-languages that seem to have been borrowed from different groups that they were connected to.
Americans in our English, huh?
Yeah, so in my case, my focus was on words of cosmology, which is the study of the creation tradition of the tribe, which is what the religion is about. And all these words of cosmology are the ones that I can tie back to ancient Egypt. One really interesting aspect of those words is that they don't just have a single meaning. They have multiple meanings. And in a classic situation, any Dogon cosmological word actually has two meanings, and the meanings are disconnected from each other so that if you knew one, you couldn't guess the other. For example, the name of the Dogon creator god is Ama, and that word Ama can mean hidden, but it can also mean to grasp or to hold firm. Now, those two meanings are logically disconnected from each other, that you can't get to one by knowing the other. And so when you go to another culture like ancient Egypt and you find a comparable word that's pronounced similarly and carries both of those disconnected meanings, you're in pretty good shape to conclude that the words are related to each other in the context of the cosmology. And so it's not exactly a linguistic study so much as it is a comparison of words, the same way you would compare symbols or gods or myths between two cultures.
I know this is probably far from your area of expertise, but you may know the answer anyhow. As far as their genealogical connection, is there one between the ancient Egyptians and the Dogon?
There could be, but there's no absolute proof of it. Part of the problem is that the Dogon don't have a written language, and so they don't have written records of what happened. We're not certain what happened to them before a certain point. We know that around 1500 A.D., they lived along the Niger River, and they decided to move from there in order to avoid conversion to Islam. But before that, all we have to go on are just tribal myths and tribal stories about where they might have come from in farther east. So it's really just circumstantial evidence that points to a relationship with the Egyptians.
So there hasn't been a comparison of their modern DNA with the DNA from the mummies?
It would be difficult because there's been so much intermarriage and so much intermixing of cultures within Africa that it would be very hard to track with absolute certainty to say, hey, there was a connection here.
Because I know they've made such great advances in the DNA tracing that often they can say, yes, this person was related to this ethnic group or was not related.
Well, yes, they can trace it through, especially through the maternal DNA. But I'm not sure that anybody's made that kind of a study of the Dogon trying to demonstrate whether or not they were connected to the Egyptians or not. All of my evidences are sort of circumstantial. And what they point to is a connection between the Dogon and the Egyptians right just before the appearance of language in ancient Egypt, which is right at the boundary between pre-dynastic Egypt and dynastic Egypt. And so you find things in Dogon mythology that are a good fit for pre-dynastic symbols and deities and so forth and words, and are also a good fit for very early Egypt. Because the Dogon don't have a written language, but they do have a lot of the symbols that are used in Egyptian hieroglyphs, it looks like the Dogon preserve a version of ancient Egyptian culture that fell right there before writing appeared.
So the symbols are sort of like our, I guess you might say the equivalent of our universal sign language, or whatever it is called, you know, with the various characters that tell you this is a restroom, don't park here, this is where cars go, and so forth and so on.
Well, yes, except that from the Dogon standpoint, most of the symbols they have that are related to concepts are connected to their concepts of cosmology. They're trying to explain how creation happened. And so the drawings are almost the equivalent of scientific diagrams to document these stages of creation the way the Dogon mythology says it happened.
So what is the basics of their story of creation?
Okay, well, the Dogon say that their mythology describes how their tribal god Amma created matter and created life. And they tell basically one series, they describe one series of progressions, one series of symbols that is meant to simultaneously describe how matter is formed and how biological reproduction happens. So that the stages, they relate the stages to each other. And so I happened to notice as I was studying them that the Dogon talk about it from the top down, and they were describing what sounded to me like an atom. And then it also sounded like they had correct descriptions of the components of an atom, which are electrons, protons, and neutrons. And so I asked myself at that point, not having much knowledge of astrophysics myself, I asked myself, is it possible that the other stages that they lay out could also be correct in terms of modern science. And I started educating myself, reading Brian Greene and Stephen Hawking's books, and trying to find parallels between what the Dogon were saying and what modern scientists say about creation. As it turns out, each stage in the formation of matter lines up. And not only does it line up in terms of a description, but many times the Dogon provide a drawing, which is what these hieroglyphic-like symbols are, that is a very close match for the scientific diagram that Brian Greene or Stephen Hawking uses to represent the same stage of matter or biological reproduction. So as I started lining those up, I realized, wow, we really have something here. This looks like it even goes a little bit deeper than what modern scientists have figured out. For example, Stephen Hawking doesn't try to talk about what causes matter in its wave-like form to suddenly behave like a particle. But the Dogon do. And so there are little mysteries. Stephen Hawking doesn't know which of the 200,000 potential shapes for what's called a Calabi-Yau space in string theory is the right shape. But the Dogon do have a shape they say is the right shape. And so it seemed to me that there were things to be learned by studying the Dogon tradition.
So where would they have gotten this knowledge? I mean, that's not something that you're going to figure out when you're banging a few rocks together around a fire.
Oh, that's right. Well, the Dogon say they learned it from somebody who knew more than they did. They credit ancient teachers. But as it turns out, the symbols that make up this Dogon tradition are the same symbols that Carl Jung noticed, are present virtually everywhere in the world. And you go to any region in the world and you find similar mythological themes and mythological symbols. And you go to cultures like the Mayan, or go to the ancient Vedic, or the Chinese, or ancient North American Indians, and if you follow it back far enough, what you eventually arrive at is a statement that there were ancestor teachers, ancient ancestor teachers, who taught the skills of civilization to early humanity, and who were associated with these myths and symbols. And so,
I've heard many of those stories myself, and usually these teachers promised to return.
Right. And the Dogon priests consider it to be a turning point of the world when these teachers actually left. And they hope that they would return. But, so, the best thing you can really say from the Dogon is that someone who was smarter than they were, someone who knew more, better educated than they were the source of this information for the Dogon. Now, the Dogon, since they don't have a system of writing, have had to preserve this tradition, this religious tradition, by oral tradition, by word of mouth from one person to another down through centuries.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, the way they do that is through a complicated system of mnemonics. I'll give you an example. When my wife and my children were very young, we were worried about what was going to happen to them if we took them out into a crowd, like a state fair or a county fair, and they got lost. You know, they didn't know their address, they didn't know their phone number. They would have no way of finding us again if they got separated from us. So what we decided to do was to teach them to sing a song, and the words to the song were their address or their phone number.
Uh-huh.
And so now if someone said to them, little girl or little boy, where do you live? They would sing back the little song that told the address. And that's the sort of technique that you find among the Dogon, is there are certain actions and certain rituals they go through that to recreate different kinds of knowledge. And acts of everyday life center on this. So the way they weave a cloth, or the way they plow a field, or the way they go about their daily life is constantly reminding them of details of this secret tradition.
So it would reinforce this secret How was it secret? I mean, did they try to keep it away from outsiders?
It's interesting in that, in truth, anyone in the tribe can learn it. So it's not a secret from that standpoint. The men learn it, the boys learn it from the men, and the girls learn it from the women. And anyone who sincerely wants to learn it is allowed to do it. But the driving force for behind learning has to come from the student. The student is expected to ask the next question to learn the next thing. And if they reach a point where they no longer pursue it by asking the next question, then that's where their education stops. And the ones who choose to pursue it the farthest are the ones who eventually become priests.
Uh-huh.
So, again, it's, the rule with the Dogon priests is that if I were to ask a question of a Dogon priest that they considered appropriate to my level of initiation in their secret tradition, they're required to tell me a truthful answer. But if I come along and I ask a question that they feel is inappropriate to my standing, then they're required to either lie to me or actually to remain silent, or if necessary, to lie to me to protect the tradition.
Uh-huh.
So as an outsider, if I were to walk into a Dogon village and approach a Dogon priest and say, "So, tell me all about the innermost secrets of your religion," they would deny that they knew anything about it.
Uh-huh. Well, that kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, after seeing how history has had religions come in and just swallow up entire cultures, they must have been very protective of that religious tradition. I mean, they moved a considerable distance, too, wasn't it?
Yes, and that's fairly common with the ancient priestly tribes. The Dogon were a priestly tribe, but it's not uncommon even in North America or in China or in various parts of the world for a group of priests to deliberately set out and leave the main group and locate themselves in some partially inhospitable climate. The Dogon live in the desert along cliffs. In a place that nobody in the right mind would really want to go. It's 115 degrees in May there. And so anyone who comes there has got to really want to be there.
Yeah, especially since I don't think they have air conditioning, do they?
No, they don't. So these inhospitable locales are a real good place to preserve this kind of a tradition. It tends not to change because there aren't a lot of outsiders who are coming in to corrupt it.
So if you wanted to take another jump without anything to support it, just by saying, you know, this could be the remnants of a group of priests and priestesses that left Egypt at that brink just before writing was developed, for religious reasons even.
It's true. I mean, I see it in a lot of ways. You know how periodically with a computer, if you know you're about to install the latest version of some software package, you might make a backup copy first, the way it was before you take the next step.
Right.
And that's sort of the way I see this, is that just before the introduction of the concept of writing, which was a civilizing skill, that a group of priests deliberately left with the idea of preserving the tradition the way that it was prior to that next step.
Well, and two, people in general resist change, and the change of, you know, this writing being a bit, you know, introduced as a radical concept might have inspired a group to desire to set themselves apart. Unlike the Amish have done today.
Yes, and what's interesting is that there are other cultures that preserve a similar tradition to this. Some of them have writing and some of them don't. But it's interesting that, in my experience, the ones that did not adopt writing did a better job of preserving it. That the mnemonic tradition is actually a better way of recording it, a more precise way of passing it down than written text. Because, like in Egypt, when you rely on written text, eventually your texts don't hold up. The tablets break and papyruses or
someone comes along
and
have a bonfire.
Right, and so if you rely on technology to maintain your knowledge, then rather than relying on memory to maintain it, then you run the risk of losing it.
Well, just imagine now if suddenly the entire world was hit with a devastation such as hit Haiti right now. We would lose our technology, probably most of our books, and where would we be, you know, 50 or 100 years or 1,500 years later?
And actually the way I look at it is right now we'd be in pretty good shape, but we're on the brink of this. During this last holiday season, Amazon.com sold more electronic books than they did paper books, which says to me that we're just on the cusp right now of it reaching a point that books will no longer be a profitable way to go, and the books will start to disappear.
I have to admit, you know, even myself, I had resisted the idea of electronic books, and I don't have one of these electronic book reader gizmos, so I have to read them on my computer. And even with a laptop, that's relatively inconvenient compared to the portability of a book.
Right. Well, I don't mind having an electronic copy of a book, because a lot of time for research, it's nice to be able to scan the text for things and so forth. But not as a substitute for the printed book, but in addition to the printed book.
And I think a lot of people are looking at, you know, in terms of the expense environmentally wise of a actual book with paper versus the electronic version. I tend to get overwhelmed with unread magazines.
Yes.
But in the ones I get via an electronic subscription, they're there. If I want to find a recipe that was in a magazine that came 3 years ago, it's right there. It's not taking any space, collecting any dust. The cats aren't using it as a,
yes,
a surfboard through the living room, you know.
But then I look at my old family movies, which started out on film. And I can tell you that there's a long trail of family footage scattered in 14 different technologies, you know, that are no longer readable. You know, we've gone from how many, we've gone through videotapes, we've gone through CDs, and we've gone through, in audio, we've gone through cassettes and 8-track and CDs and so forth. That over time, what's going to happen is if you're relying on a technology, you're only asking that technology to become obsolete, and when it becomes obsolete, you lose whatever's on the media.
Yeah, you know, I think about the library of videotapes that I had when my kids were growing up. I had thousands of movies and other programs that we watched, because we lived in an area where there was no television. And so, you know, if you wanted something, you bought it, because the expense of renting it and then having to drive clear to the town that you rented it from and return it was just, no, we'll just buy it. And, you know, granted, we didn't probably get as many, but, you know, for the price of renting 3 movies, we could buy a movie. And so, you know, we had all these thousands of movies. Well, now if I wanted to watch them, I would have to buy them again.
Then to go back to the idea of the power of mnemonics, we have certain family friends who were around at the time we were teaching these songs to our kids to memorize their address and their phone number. I can't tell you how many of our friends still remember our address and our phone number by singing the little song to themselves, even though they may have only heard it once. I remember an episode of Cheers where, I don't know if you're familiar with the comedy where Coach is trying to teach Sam about history, and he's using mnemonics to do it. And he makes up a little song about Albania to teach him some facts about Albania. And my wife and I heard this song one time on the episode as it played, and both of us immediately acquired all that information about Albania. We could both sing the song back and recreate the information that was being conveyed.
And, so, you know, if you teach things to children today, even in our culture, like the ABC song, most women cannot say the alphabet. Now, more men can say it than women. But they cannot say the alphabet. They're automatically going to go into that sing-song that starts every kid in kindergarten across the nation.
Right, and if you think of just little things, all the mnemonic aids, like, you know, 30 days has September, April, June, May, you know, and November, right?
You know, in my case, learning to spell Mississippi. My mother taught us M-I, crooked letter, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, back up, back I, and my daughter was laughing because I did the same thing with her. And she now lives in Mississippi, and she was saying, you know, every time I go to spell it, that song goes through my head.
Mnemonics are very, very, very powerful. Okay, now, what's interesting is that, okay, the history of the Dogon is that they were studied by some French anthropologists for three decades in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and then an anthropological study of their religion was written up. 30 years later, the Dogon were restudied, which is a sort of an unusual thing. It's not unusual for one anthropologist to restudy some aspect of another anthropologist's work, but in the 1975, the Dogon became controversial because of Robert Temple's work, his book, A Serious Mystery. And suddenly in 1980, there was a team of anthropologists led by Belgian professor Walter van Beek to go in and restudy the entire work of the original French anthropologists, who represented a large share of the entire life's work of this anthropologist. And the odd thing was that the man who led the second wave of anthropologists, his specialty wasn't even religion. His prior specialty had been ecology. And so you send someone who does not have an overview of ancient religions to study what's described as a secret tradition, and he and his companions found no evidence of the tradition that Marcel Griot said existed. Now, I compare this to a visitor to a college campus on parents' weekend coming away having seen no evidence of drug or alcohol use. Okay, now, they might well come away and say, gee, I didn't see anything, but you've got the whole entire community there who, according to the first anthropologist, have a vested interest in not telling you the truth about the tradition. If you walk in out of the cold and start asking questions, they're going to either remain silent or they're going to deny knowledge or they're going to lie. Okay, so Professor Van Beek concluded that, at first he concluded that the Dogon priests had simply made up this tradition as a way of satisfying the questions of the French anthropologists. And then a little later on down the line, he decided that the French anthropologist, or he implied that the French anthropologist had made it up himself. But what the Belgian didn't understand was that the system of religion that was being described by the French anthropologist is point for point the same as ancient Buddhism. In other words, the Dogon priest couldn't possibly have just casually made it up, because that would be saying they casually invented Buddhism.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, had the Belgian anthropologist had enough of an overview of ancient religions, in fairness to him, a half a century passed, and not one person who studied the Dogon realized that there was a relationship between Buddhism and the Dogon religion. But it's not just a relationship. They are point for point the same. And because they are point for point the same, and they both have been passed down through the ages, mostly through oral tradition, that demonstrates that neither one of them could have changed very much. Because there's almost no chance that this very, very complicated system could have ended up the same in both cultures if they hadn't started out the same in both cultures.
That's very true. That's true. Now, I had a question in the virtual auditorium about which branch of Buddhism, the traditional Indian, Tibetan, Chinese, Japanese, all the sects differ.
Okay. This is Buddhist stupa cosmology is what I'm talking about. there is a traditional aligned ritual structure of Buddhism called a stupa. It's a structure that is purely a symbolic structure. It's not meant to have a purpose. It's there to be symbolic of the creation tradition that it represents. Okay, now that architectural form is a match for a Dogon aligned structure called a granary that they build, built on the same base plan and evoking the same series of shapes in the same sequence associated with the same symbolism. Each shape has symbolism attached to it. And so there's a series of steps to building the structure that, if you can remember how to do it, you're recreating the shapes of the cosmology and the symbolism that go with it. Okay, so my daughter visited in India for a few weeks when she was in college, and when she came back, she reported to me that she had seen this aligned ritual structure in India that reminded her an awful lot of my Dogon granary. And so I said to her, look, don't tell me anything more about it. Let me make some cold predictions here about what the symbolism of the shape is going to be. Before we discuss it any further, I'll write down 6 or 7 points of what I think must be true about it symbolically, and then we'll go online and we'll do some research and see if we can prove that it's true. Mm-hmm. And so we did that, and sure enough, every point that I predicted was correct about the stupa. And so from there, I found a book called The Symbolism of the Stupa, which was written by Adrian Snodgrass, who is a world authority on Buddhist architecture and symbolism. He's from the University of West Sydney, Australia. And when you read his book, which was written without any regard whatsoever to the Dogon, you can line up point for point, shape for shape, symbol for symbol, concept for concept, what's true about Buddhist stupa symbolism with what's true, according to the French anthropologist, for the Dogon. In other words, they're the same system. Now, the Dogon, when they moved from the Niger River, the area of northern Africa that they moved from is a known ancient home of Buddhism.
Okay.
And so it's entirely understandable that the tradition that they would have carried with them would have similarities to Buddhism. But there's more to it, because the structures that get evoked as you build this aligned ritual structure, the shapes that get evoked, are a perfect blueprint to fit the ancient Egyptian gods and goddesses into in the way that they emerge according to the tradition in Egypt. In other words, you've got the Aeneid gods and goddesses who emerge in a particular order. Now, those line up with the symbols in the Dogon and the Buddhist traditions that emerge in the same order and the same configuration. So basically, you're laying out a blueprint that is a match for ancient Egyptian cosmology.
So that really connects the Buddhist religion with the ancient Egyptians as well, doesn't it?
That's right, it does. And so my third book, which is in the works at the moment, is an attempt to take all these different, the similarities of all these different cultures that I've interrelated in my first two books, and take a guess at what the parent cosmology would have looked like that generated these.
And what is your new book going to be titled?
Well, that's a good question. Now, the publisher has not settled on a title yet. My working title is As Above, So Below, The Plan of the Ancient Cosmologies.
And when is it anticipated to be released?
October 2010. And what I do in the book is I lay out what I consider to be the signature aspects of this parent cosmology, like explaining how symbolism works and how symbolism attaches itself to symbols, and you know, what key attributes you would expect to find in any cosmology that descended from this parent cosmology. And then, having laid that out, I examine the cosmology of a little-known Chinese priestly tribe called the Naki from Tibet. There, they live at the border between Tibet and China. Mm-hmm. And I demonstrate how every single one of those signature attributes plays out in this little Chinese tribe that I had never studied before.
Ah, okay.
And also demonstrate how there are certain academic mysteries about that tribe that if you look at them in the context of cosmology, suddenly certain mysteries go away, like why the tribe named itself what it did and things like that. What the tribe in China happens to preserve the last surviving hieroglyphic language in the world, and I'm able to predict. It's known that the symbols of their hieroglyphic language were derived from cosmology, which is what I say happened in Egypt. Well, I'm able to predict with certain shapes, how these hieroglyph shapes, what the meaning of the shape is going to be in China and which words it's going to turn up in, based on what I know about the Dogon and about ancient Egypt. And so part of the book is to lay out these examples of how the glyphs relate to the cosmology.
Yeah, that's... So often we forget that the ancient peoples, though they be long dead and gone and their language and culture forgotten, they are still influencing who we are today. Because you look at these connections and, you know, those religions are still alive and in mainstream cultures today.
That's true.
You know, and to see the overlap between the things that they preserved in their religion and science kind of makes you go,
Yes, now, as I was progressing with my studies, I realized that there was a relationship between the shapes that Dogon, developed as part of their cosmology and specific concepts, like the notion that a circle with a dot in the middle of it represents the sun. This is a concept that gets evolved early in Buddhism and in Buddhist stupa symbolism and in by the Dogon. And the meanings of that shape in the cosmology are the same meanings that are traditionally assigned to that shape in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic language and in this Chinese language. And so it occurred to me, what would happen if, when I looked at an Egyptian word, if I picked a simple Egyptian word that was written with shapes just found in the cosmology, what would happen if I substituted concepts for shapes? What I found was that each Egyptian word turns into a symbolic sentence. For example, the Egyptian word for year is written with two glyphs. The first is the time glyph, and the second glyph is this circle with a dot in the middle of it. And I said, based on the cosmology, that says the time of the year is orbited around the sun. When you go to the Egyptian word for month and substitute concepts for glyphs, it reads, the moon makes an orbit. When you go to the word for seasons, it says three arcs of the orbit around the sun. And I thought, three arcs? Shouldn't it be four? And I did some research, and sure enough, the Egyptians only observed three seasons.
Okay.
When I went to the Egyptian word for week, it said 10 days. I said 10 days, and I went back, did some research. Sure enough, the Egyptians had a 10-day week. In other words, each one of these words of cosmology, the symbols define the word. That if you understand the relationship between the symbol and the concepts, you can understand why the word means what it means. It's not just letters like ABC. It's you're stringing the other concepts to produce a more complicated concept. Every word is like a sentence. And then later I discovered that, okay, in certain Egyptian hieroglyphic words there is a trailing glyph at the end of the word that nobody knows quite why it's there. The Egyptologists say it's because the shape is related to the meaning of the word, they say that it's sort of drawn into the word for emphasis. But what I discovered is that the reason the glyph is there is because the leading glyphs of the word, the symbolic sentence, defines the meaning of that trailing glyph. And that if once you realize this, you can go through the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and get it to tell you what the meaning of all, the symbolic meaning is of all of its own glyphs. Just by finding these what I call defining words.
Uh-huh.
So my second book is devoted primarily to laying out how that process works with Egyptian hieroglyphic words.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's fascinating to watch someone, you know, essentially take a fresh approach to the glyphs and their interpretation. Because where you weren't a linguist or an anthropologist, you were looking at it in terms of pure symbology.
Right.
No more than a figure in a language used to program a computer.
Right. Now, there is a problem to my approach, and the problem is that it works best if you do your research using an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary that was developed in the 1900s by Sir Wallace Budge.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is a dictionary that's out of favor now.
Uh-huh.
And to understand what the process is, okay, the Egyptian hieroglyphic language remained in use for about 3,000 years. Now, if you compare that to English, you know, if we go back to Shakespeare's time, we're still only talking about 400 years.
Uh-huh.
So the Egyptian hieroglyphs were in use for 3,000 years, and with various regions and so forth.
You would see a lot of a language shift occurring during that time period. I mean,
right.
If you compare it to the evolution of languages just in computers in the last 20 years.
Right. So now what I've done is I've taken a body, a coherent body of words, which are the words of Dogon cosmology, and I've shown word for word, meaning for meaning, that they are in agreement with Budge's dictionary.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's not a good thing from the standpoint of a traditional Egyptologist, because their view is that Budge's dictionary is not right.
Uh-huh.
But my outlook is Budge's dictionary can't be as wrong as they say it is and yet still be in agreement with the Dogon.
It might be like a lot of other researchers. He may be right, you know, a large percentage of the time, and something that they're, you know, I guess developing their entire platform of he's wrong could be that little margin of error.
Well, yes, and also the whole question of right and wrong about language is an iffy one. Imagine that, you know, 5,000 years from now, somebody's studying English, and they decide that the language that has the best relationship to English is German. And so they base their interpretations of how to pronounce words and what the meanings, what certain words mean on German words. Okay? Now,
yeah.
If you try to line that up with how words are pronounced in the Deep South or what they meant, or worse yet, let's say you took Shakespearean words like the word fardel to the word bodkin and tried to line it up with a modern dictionary that would lean heavily towards the German, you might not ever find the match.
Nope, not at all.
If you're going to line up, if you look at Shakespearean words, you need to look at the dictionary that is a Shakespearean dictionary.
And if you even go back further to the first written English documents and you read that stuff aloud, nobody can understand it today.
That's right. I mean, that's what the poem Jabberwocky was making fun of.
Yeah, well, you know, and it is. It's just so difficult to understand. And it wasn't. I had a hard time with it until, in the process of learning German, I was taught the association between Old English and German.
Right.
And it's just like much simpler. But initially, it was like, that's English.
Right.
You know, it didn't sound anything like the language we speak today.
So my outlook is that Budge's dictionary leans more towards the African word forms, and the preferred dictionary of the Egyptologist leans more towards Greek and Coptic word forms that were in existence 3,000 years later. And so anyone who's trying to study African language and connect it with ancient Egypt, and the Egyptologists insist that they use the modern dictionary, the preferred dictionary, it almost guarantees they're not going to find relationships. And so
I'm offering up
the Dogon words, the Dogon cosmological words, as evidence, new evidence, that Budge's dictionary actually is not very far off the mark if you're making comparisons to African word forms.
And even today, if you take the common man, especially the ones towards the bottom tier of education level, take someone who speaks English from various parts of North America, Australia, New Zealand, England, put them in a room and you will swear they're different languages.
Yes.
They really can't even communicate with each other sometimes.
That's right, and I have a niece from New Zealand, and she was visiting with us this summer, and there are really only a couple of vowel sounds that they pronounce differently from the way we pronounce them, and yet, if she speaks quickly, we couldn't understand what she was saying.
Right, and sometimes word meaning is entirely different. Something that's very innocent in one area has very much less than innocent connotations in another area.
Absolutely. My sister, who migrated to New Zealand, would use the expression, "I'm rooting for a team." Well, in New Zealand, the term rooting has sexual connotations.
Yes.
You're not just cheering the team on. So,
uh-huh.
I mean, after a meal, if you say, "I'm stuffed," the implication is you're pregnant.
Yeah, or, you know, in England, if you're getting knocked up, you're getting woke up.
Yeah, that's it. It's not quite the same here.
Nope, not at all. And so, you know, yeah, there's some very different meanings to the same words.
Okay.
But it's now time for us to take a break. So hold those thoughts.
All right.
Well, the Dawn of Shades will be right back with our guest, Laird Scranton, after this brief break. In the meantime, you can check out our webpage, www.exogenynetwork.com. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. Tonight's guest is Laird Scranton, and we have lots of interesting things to talk about. And I would like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, and let me know what you think of it. There are links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you have a question that you wish to have asked, you can email it to me at gscott@gmail.com, and I am monitoring the email during the program with Laird Scranton tonight, so I'll try real hard not to miss anything. Now, Laird, where exactly were we?
Well, I was about to say that the net of all this study is that I feel like I have access to sources of information that are unique in terms of being able to understand ancient religion and language. I'll give you, for instance, as part of my new book, one of the things I wanted to do, I wanted to write a chapter about symbolism. And I was trying very hard to come up with a succinct definition of what a symbol is. And I had thought about this long and hard, had come up with several different working definitions that I eventually rejected as just not getting to the heart of the matter. And finally, out of frustration, I realized, you know, I'm stupid here. I have the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary in front of me, and the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary defines its own terms. Each word defines itself. All I need to do is find the word or words in the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary for a symbol, and it should tell me something about a symbol I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And so I discovered there were two words for a symbol. The first one, when you read it my way, reads, action preserves knowledge.
Uh-huh.
The second word reads, action replicates knowledge. Now, what's most interesting is that the word that says action preserves knowledge is pronounced Hashem. Now, in Hebrew, Hashem is a term that's substituted for the name of God as a symbol when trying to discuss concepts relating to God. Rather than using the name of God, the word God, they substitute a symbol. One of the words they use in place of the name of God is Hashem. Another is Adonai, which relates to a Dogon word Aduno, which means symbol in the Dogon language.
Ah.
Okay, so in Dogon culture, because they don't have a written language, symbols have very little to do with writing down a figure the way they do in modern culture. You know, a symbol is not a drawn or a written shape necessarily. Symbolism relates to actions and the things you do. I was saying before, like how you plow a field or how you weave a cloth has, or how you build a granary has symbolic meaning. And it's through these acts that a concept is recorded. And by repeating the act is the way that you play back the concept. So these days, whenever I come across a concept of ancient culture, ancient cosmology that I don't completely understand, for instance, someone was asking me recently about what I thought about the concept of the celestial ladder, which is a concept that exists in a number of ancient cultures. Well, I realized that if I went to Buddhism, to Buddhist stupa symbolism, and found out what it said about the concept of the celestial ladder, and then I went to Dogon culture and found out what they said, and then I went to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and found out what they said, and I discovered that all the concepts agreed with each other and matched, that I was pretty certain I was on to the actual meaning of the celestial ladder. And I could do this with pretty much any term that turns up. And so I use the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary more as an encyclopedia than a dictionary. And I use the Dogon Anthropological Studies as a guidebook for understanding why. Because in the anthropological studies, they give rationales for the reasons the Dogon do each of the things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Someone was asking me if I agreed with Robert Bovall's Orion correlation theory, which suggests that the three big pyramids at Giza were meant to line up with the belt stars of Orion. Well, when you go to the Dogon Anthropologic Study, there's a section there that explains that the Dogon have a practice, a ritual, a tradition of placing large stones on a plateau to represent stars that are important to their cosmology, and that among those stars are the belt stars of Orion, which they call Atanu.
Uh-huh.
The word Atanu also means deputy. Now you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and discover that the Egyptian word for deputy is Atenu.
Uh-huh.
So now you've got an agreement between the tradition, which is the placing of large stones on a plateau to represent stars, and you've got a specific word that links those three particular stars to the Egyptian concept of those three particular stars. And so I come away from it and I say, yes, absolutely. The Dogon have a tradition of representing Orion's belt with those those stones, it only makes sense that the Egyptians did too.
So what is the, what does the Belt of Orion represent to the Dogon?
With that question, you just got to the heart of my third book. And to the heart of the concept of as above, so below.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The phrase as above, so below is the hermetic phrase that it's one of the key phrases of the esoteric tradition, of the secret religion, ancient religion.
Uh-huh.
And it implies that creation as we see it in the universe above us is parallel. Those processes of creation are parallel to, in some way, the processes of creation as matter is formed in the realm below us, so to speak, conceptually. In other words, the processes that form an atom are the same in some fundamental way as the processes that form stars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the three belt stars of Orion are a necessary key to point us to, I believe, are a necessary key to point us to a particular structure that's not obvious in the cosmos above us. It's a structure that the Dogon describe, and it's the equivalent to the basic building block of matter that I referred to earlier as the Calabi-Yau space in string theory. It's a little wrapped up bundle of dimensions that supposedly exist at every point in matter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's like the fundamental building block.
Okay.
So as it turns out, there are a series of symbols connected with Giza that point us specifically to this structure in the cosmos that is a direct link. Its definition in science is the exact counterpart to the Dogon definition of this little wrapped up bundle in the formation of matter. And
okay.
So, to my way of thinking, the reason for going to all the trouble of putting up those pyramids to point to the belt stars was to get us to recognize that the structure exists in that direction in space.
It's like one answer leads to more questions.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, you know, why were they so connected with those three particular stars?
And so, well, from a standpoint of cosmology, conceptually the cosmology begins with this little structure in the formation of matter, and it ends with its gigantic counterpart up in outer space. And if you can grasp that, how those two structures relate to each other, you've got your arms around the concepts of creation.
But why those three stars and not three other stars?
Because those three stars are located in a spot that pinpoints the structure you need to find.
Okay.
Now, the structure is also of a particular size. It's of a particular dimension. The structure that's not obvious out in the cosmos that they're trying to point us to has specific dimensions and light years. And when you get back to the Great Pyramid and the definition of a cubit, that definition, the way that we know how big a cubit is because of the dimensions of the Great Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Those dimensions tell us, predict in advance for us, what the dimensions of the structure are that is being pointed to out in the direction of the belt star.
So it's the dimensions of the pyramid predict the distance away these stars are?
No, they predict the dimensions of the structure we're looking for. It's like if I told you how big your house was, you know, the measurements of your house across the front and across the sides.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the dimensions of the pyramid tell us how big that structure is, how big a thing we're looking for. And once I realize that, then I can go to Google and key in the dimensions and key in the word Orion and turn up the structure that I didn't know existed out there. And when I found the structure that I didn't know existed out there, I looked up the scientific definition of what it is, what it's called, how it's formed, and I realized that it's an exact match for what Shadogan said we would find there, and an exact match for what Shadogan says is the key building block of matter. In other words, in our own neighborhood, in the universe, we have an example, a big example, a large example, one that we can look at and examine of one of these tiny structures that's the building block of matter. So if we're concerned about how matter is formed, it would behoove us to go learn as much as we could about this big structure that we can see, as opposed to trying to study the teensy-tiny one we can't see.
That's interesting. And at the same time, I'll admit, I'm definitely not that well-educated in string theory and subatomic particles and whatnot. My education has been rather sparse in those areas. So the structure of the pyramid, or the size, the dimensions of the pyramid, are related to the very basic construction of matter.
Okay, and let me back up a little bit more. There's a researcher by the name of Scott Creighton, and he one of the things he likes to do is to overlay geometry on like the plan of Giza and so forth, to try to learn new things from the geometry, from the mathematics, hoping the mathematics will point him to something. Okay, he took a photograph of the three stars, the three belt stars of Orion,
right,
in relationship to each other, and overlaid that on top of an aerial view of the three Giza pyramids to show how they line up. Okay, and I said to him, gee, Scott, you know, if they do line up, then chances are there's a relationship. You can demonstrate that there's a relationship between the distance between those stars in light years and the distance between the pyramids in cubits.
Yeah, now the light bulb is beginning to get some power.
Okay, so
I'm starting to understand what you're trying to tell me there.
Okay, so I said, if they really do line up with each other, then it's proportional that somewhere there's a relationship between cubits and light years, because the distance in cubits between the pyramids covers the same relative space as the distance between the actual stars in space. So then, following my own suggestion, I went to the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary, and I started exploring words for cubit. And what I discovered was that the Egyptian word for cubit is really a compound word, you know, just like a traditional English compound word. It's two words that make up one word. The first word is the Egyptian word for light, and the second word is the Egyptian word for measure. In other words, the name of a cubit means light measure. Now, once I realized that, then I could take the dimensions that I had come to understand were significant dimensions of the Great Pyramid and relate that to light years, and realize that I was looking for a structure whose dimensions were going to be this many light years by this many light years.
And here I'd always been told the cubit was the length between your elbow and something.
It is, but symbolically, what that represents, from my standpoint, from my understanding, is a light year.
In terms of the symbology and construction of the pyramids on the...
Do you remember there's a Star Trek episode where Spock is concerned about giving an uncoded message to Captain Kirk over an unsecure phone line? And so he makes some kind of a statement that says, well, if hours were minutes, it will take X number of hours to repair our warp drive. Or if days were hours. It will take X number of days to repair our warp drive. Trying to throw off their enemy to think that it's going to take them 3 or 4 or however many days to repair their ship, when in fact it's only going to take that many hours. Well, that's sort of what this is like, is that when they're talking cubits, they want us to think light years. And when we do that, we get one piece of the puzzle of the structure we're looking for that's being pointed to by those belt stars on the ground. We're looking for the structure that's in the direction of those belt stars that has this size.
And that makes, you know, me curious as to, A, how did they get the knowledge? Because they weren't supposed to have the technology to be able to do that.
Again, they got it from somebody, they say they got it from somebody who knew more than they did. The Buddhists say they got it from a non-human source. And in Egypt, okay, the Dogon relate the teachers to the stars of Sirius.
Uh-huh.
In the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the word for teacher is the same, pronounced the same way as the word for Sirius. So, if someone had to, someone said, time's up, you got to tell me what you think right now, what happened, I would say that somebody from the direction of Sirius deliberately conducted a Peace Corps type effort here to help us acquire civilizing skills, to teach us how to weave cloth, how to cultivate seeds and plant fields and harvest crops and so forth. And as a part of that process, there were certain skills we needed to make that happen. We had to have calendars, we had to understand concepts of time, hours, minutes, and days. We had to know how to build, we had to have skills in metallurgy to be able to create the basic tools we needed to be able to plow a field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the Dogon system of cosmology, on one level, are the stages of that civilizing plan. And the civilizing plan is laid out in parallel with the stages by which matter is formed and the stages by which biological reproduction happens. So they set up an equivalency between these things.
Well, that's very, very interesting. And what time period, what year?
About 3400 B.C.
About 3400 B.C. So that's, you know, over 5,000 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, we didn't progress very fast.
No, it didn't. I think that whoever laid out the original plan expected that things would go quicker than that. Didn't anticipate all the setbacks and delays that we were going to have over the centuries.
Yeah, you know, everything from, and when really you take things like the event that just happened in Haiti, the famines that have struck Africa, the floods that have hit the United States, the fires that have devastated Australia. And when you look at all these kinds of natural disasters that go on, and if you consider that, you know, maybe this Peace Corps sort of effort focused on a few thousand people in a relatively small geographic area, you know, and as it spread, it was faced with even more natural disasters. Yeah, they did kind of have a rough road to go.
Although, from what I can see, the same plan was deliberately presented all around the globe in different areas.
Right.
That's the reason why myths and symbols are the same. It seems like they're the same everywhere you go. It's not because of some inbred predisposition that we have. It's because they all were taught by the same teachers or taught. It's as if you had studied the same math book as somebody who lived in California.
Well, yeah, I know, you know, Native Americans have traditions of people who came from the stars.
Right. Well, the Hopi Indians have pretty much everything I told you about the Dogon is can be shown to be true to some extent for the Hopi Indians and for other North American tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a concept called polygenesis. And polygenesis says if you've got two cultures that are at the same stage of development and they have the same tools and the same materials at their disposal, they're likely to build the same things. In other words, if all you've got is building blocks or blocks of stone, sooner or later you're going to figure out how to stack them up to make a pyramid. And so it's no big whoop that two cultures would would have built pyramids. Of course they would. That's what you're going to build on the blocks of stone. But the reason the polygenesis is wrong is because in each of these cultures, there's very complicated symbolism that goes along with that pyramid that you don't automatically get simply because you decided to stack a bunch of stones up. For example, the faces of a pyramid typically are associated with certain star groups, and those star groups are used to control the agricultural cycle. And the pyramid itself is compared to a woman lying on her back, such that the pyramid represents her impregnated womb. Okay, now, that kind of symbolism would not automatically fall out because of the materials that the culture had at their disposal. That symbolism, for that to be the same, you know, and some of it's pretty bizarre symbolism, to be the same from culture to culture, implies that it came from the same source.
So these, we'll call them Peace Corps teams, came down and landed in multiple locations.
Yep.
Essentially is what you're telling me.
Yep, from what I can see, they deliberately, starting with a single plan that remained remarkably the same from region to region, only they tailored certain things, like in Africa, the serpent symbol might be a cobra, whereas in North America, the serpent symbol was a rattlesnake. They wanted a tribesperson to be able to walk out of their hut and see in their daily surroundings symbols that were going to reinforce teachings. And so you have a horned animal in Egypt that might be a bull. You get to another culture, it might be a cow, or it might be a sheep. The concept's similar, but it plays out differently because of the specifics of the locale happen to be.
That definitely makes sense, because someone in North America would look at a symbol of a cobra and you've got to scratch their head.
What's that?
Yeah. Whereas, and the same thing for a rattlesnake in Egypt.
Right.
It wouldn't be a meaningful symbol of anything. So you talked about the doggone, you know, even how they plow a field is related to their symbology. You know, how does a plow field is different from the way, say, someone in England might do it, or someone here in the United States?
Okay, it's complicated, but it all goes back. Okay, it goes back to the stupa form that we talked about, or the granary form. That the idea is to try to represent how creation happens.
Mm-hmm.
How space forms from nothingness, or in the terms of the cosmology, how multiplicity emerges from unity. Okay, so as you're defining a stupa, you are recreating how multiplicity is supposedly emerged from unity. When you're weaving a cloth, or plowing a field, okay, plowing a field, you're defining units of measure at the same time you're plowing the field. That you are exercising a system of units of measure and mastering a system of units of measure at the same time that you're plowing the field. And that the field, the way that you plow it, creates a grid that is symbolic of the way that the society itself is organized. It's very complicated. It's on very many levels, but
so it's not just a case of they take their plow and they start at one side and go back and forth until it's plowed over. It's much more complicated than that.
Right, because they're taught to do a certain number of lines this direction, a certain number of lines that direction, and so forth. But the process they're taught is the same process they were taught when weaving a cloth. So now, once you understand how to weave a cloth, you've already acquired 60% of what you need to know to plow a field.
Okay. That's very, very interesting.
So the idea is to create these like units of knowledge that are applicable to something else.
So what do you think that?
Say that in order to teach you this thing, remember that thing I taught you yesterday? It's exactly the same as that, only with these differences.
So when they're weaving cloth, I mean, do they show the differences in direction and whatnot? By using different colored thread? I mean, you know, I've done some basic weaving, like most people in the United States. You know, you do it in art class or it's a craft assignment, you know, with Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or whatever. And you make a little miniature blanket or a potholder or whatever. So you have the basic idea of how a loom works.
Right. Well, in this case, the numbers that are chosen are significant numbers, numbers that are significant in the science, in creation sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that they're reinforcing certain numbers that are eventually going to be important when you get down into trying to figure out how matter is formed.
Okay. And are the lums a specific width so that the cloth is always a specific width, say a cubit or whatever?
I'm sure. I'm not familiar with all the details of okay. The weaving plan itself. I just know that the symbolism attached to it has significance in terms of cosmology and also is parallel to the symbolism that's attached to the agriculture.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I just find that, you know, very, very interesting because, you know, today in the New Age movement, you might say, you're seeing where people want to integrate the symbols of their religious and spiritual beliefs into their everyday actions.
Right.
And so this is a very new concept, and yet it has roots in a very, very old way.
Now the question comes, were the teachers God? Well, the Dogons say, no, they weren't God. As a matter of fact, they specifically claimed not to be God. They claimed to be agents of God.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, along the way, part of how they present this instruction is through four-stage metaphors, like four stages in the growth of a plant from seed to a grown plant, or four stages in the growth of a goose from an egg to a fully grown goose.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and these four-stage metaphors, probably the one you're most familiar with is water, fire, wind, and earth.
Right.
Okay, now there's another one that's based on the animal kingdom that these metaphors are there to help you orient where you are in the progression of the creation. Okay, so one of the important ones runs, it's in terms of the animal kingdom, it runs from insect to fish, a four-legged animal like a dog or a wolf to a flying bird. Okay, so now you have four relative stages, insect, fish, dog or wolf, and bird. Okay, now the Dogon, as with almost every culture on the ancient culture on the planet, refers to Sirius as the dog star. And they refer to the earth as the star of the fishes. Now, the reason for that symbolism in my mind, it says, here we're going to give you a scale by which to orient yourself as to where you stand in terms of all the other intelligent life out there, also where we stand as teachers in terms of the intelligent life.
Uh-huh.
They rated themselves, Sirius, at the level of the dog, which is not the top of the scale, it's only three quarters of the way up the scale. And they rated us at the level of the fish, which is not the bottom of the scale, but the second step up the scale.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it's as if to say to us, look, you're not the least developed that there is, and we're not the most developed that there is. We're both somewhere in the middle.
Uh-huh.
And, which is just another way of saying, we're not God, and you're better than nothing.
Yeah. You're more than an animal,
right.
Yet less than us and less than God, as
right.
We're less than God.
Right.
And that kind of makes sense. You know, if you imagine modern-day civilization missionaries instead of religious ones, going out to teach some new race discovered on a planet somewhere about, you know, how to advance.
Right, and now we get back to the question of the secret tradition that you started talking about in the first part of the interview. Why was it a secret tradition? My feeling is that these teachers had been delegated to educate us.
Uh-huh.
And had been specifically instructed not to give us deep science. But that as they thought about it and worked on it and considered how they were going to conduct this Peace Corps effort, they realized that if they were going to give us a creation tradition along with everything else, it didn't make any sense not to base it on science.
Right.
Just like if you're going to tell your child where babies come from, well, if the child is a toddler, you're going to tell them some watered-down version of the truth. You're going to say, you know, a part of the man comes together with a part of the woman to create the baby. You're not going to tell them all the gory details of how it happens, but you're going to orient them properly.
Right.
Okay. Well, whoever the teachers were, it looks to me like they did their level best to give us the real science and not to pull the punches. But they knew by doing that that they had transgressed an instruction not to do that.
Yeah, and so does I.
And so the purpose of the esoteric tradition was not to hide the science from us. The purpose of the esoteric tradition was to hide the science from anybody who might come snooping around to find out whether they give it a science.
Uh-huh.
And that's that's the way the tradition functions. That anybody who's in it as a lifelong study.
Coming out in October, we'll have to get you back so we can talk about it more.
All right, love to.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
And if you forget the names of the books or anything, if you go to exogenynetwork.com, you can click on Laird Scranton's name, and there's even links to take you straight to get the books. There's also a couple of videos and stuff embedded there from YouTube that you can take a look at. And with that, we are really, really running out of time. I want to thank you for being such a great guest, Laird.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for having me again.
I hope the entire audience has enjoyed it as well and hope that they found that it provided plenty of food for thought and more illumination for their personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we bring you another fascinating episode of The Donna Shades with our guest, Roy Abraham. And with that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.